Hi, everybody, and welcome to the 9Gs Podcast, an aviation podcast, episode 13. Before moving on, let me tell you two ways to support your show. The first way is to connect on your favorite podcast platform, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever, and then give us a 5-star if you like the show. If you don't like the show, no big deal, just comment. We know that we can improve it and give us some advices. Then let's move on to Antoine's episode. Antoine had multiple lives. He was an IT engineer, then he moved to be an air traffic controller, and then he moved from the control tower to the flight deck to become a first officer for a low-cost carrier in Europe. Let's call it SuperJet. It was an amazing chat with him, and I think that the young listeners should listen to his advices if they want to succeed in the airline industry. So without any further ado, Antoine. Antoine, thanks very much for joining me, man.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, pleasure. So you're recording from France?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Just in France, near to the border to Switzerland, where I currently work as an airline pilot.
Okay. How is the situation is going on right now in France?
Well, I think right now is a big uncertainty because basically the number of cases is increasing, but there's not so many people in hospitals. So everybody's kind of waiting. Is this going to get out of control again, or is it going to be fine? So right now it's just big uncertainty. We were quite lucky. We flew quite well this summer. So we're just kind of waiting and we'll see what will happen next. And I'm hopeful. We'll see if that's justified or not, but we'll see soon, I think.
Yeah, lucky you guys. If you've been flying a lot, that's you're very lucky guys. So right now you're recording from just next to Geneva and Switzerland. So, but you're still in France. But first of all, can you tell us how did you went to aviation? What's your professional curriculum?
I think a lot of people remember this moment or this experience where they really got hooked on aviation. Fortunately or unfortunately, I don't know which one. I don't really have this moment. I come from an aviation family, you could say. My parents, they met each other on the glider field. So I've always been part of aviation. It's always been part of my life. When I was a young child and even not so young, I spent most of my summers on glider fields. My dad would go flying in during the day, and then I'd be just playing around the airfield. So that's always been a part of my life. When I was about 10, I got to start flying model airplanes, which I enjoyed very much. So it's absolutely a great start into aviation. It's not too expensive. Back then, mm-hmm. It was a bit archaic compared to today. So aviation has always been a part of my life. And then during school, I wasn't the best student. I'll say it like that. I wasn't too bad either, but not great. So I had this kind of crossroads at one point or another, because when I was younger, I had kind of when you would ask Antoine when he was maybe 10, what do you want to do later in life? I would have kind of this list of three things. Either I wanted to be a pilot, so that was my number one choice, or an air traffic controller, or an aeronautical engineer like my father. So, of course, pilot was my first choice, but at that time, it wasn't really an option. So out of high school, I went into engineering school. I did that for 5 years. I kind of didn't forget aviation. I wouldn't go that far, but it was kind of put on the side. I was a lot into computers and IT. I'm somebody who likes technology quite a lot. So I did that, and I was very fortunate, thanks to my dad, of course, to be able to do an internship at Dassault Aviation. So the people who make the Rafale, amongst other things, yeah. So I worked on the Rafale. So this was really a dream come true in a way, because this was my second internship, and my first internship was in a big telecom company, very well known here in France. And that made me realize that the job of an engineer is not made for me. But then this last internship in Dassault kind of made me doubt the whole thing. So I was really, okay, I've done these 5 years of studying, and I was like, but it's not going to work out. I don't want to do this the rest of my life for a number of reasons. And one day I was just wandering on the internet, and I saw that the air navigation service provider, ANSP for Switzerland Skyguide, was hiring air traffic controllers, and the criteria were quite wide. So I just kind of applied. I didn't think too much about it because I thought it would never work out. So I didn't have too much pressure, and I applied, and they called me, and then I went and did the selection process. with, as I said, very little pressure because I had no expectation that it would work out. And actually, in the end, it did. So mm-hmm. it was a very pleasant experience. And I got started on that air traffic control training, which was it was very interesting. But the training environment was, I could say, awful.
Yeah. And it's kind of dense.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It was my first immersion into aviation on the operational side because Dassault was it was R&D, which I enjoy a lot as well. Trying to do a modeling of networks and things like this. That's what Dassault was, but it was very far from anything concrete. Or I wasn't building anything in the end. It was interesting, but it was very theoretical, which I enjoy to an extent. But to go into air traffic control training was really operational, and it was very interesting. Started learning a lot about the civil aviation, how it works, and all this. So this was fun. It was hard also, but the training environment, it was just plain awful. And in the end, after a year and a half, they fired everybody. It was also 2013, so it was also the financial crisis, air traffic going down. And of course, the air navigation service providers, they get paid by the number of aircraft that go through the sector. So it wasn't a good time, and it didn't work out. It was very hard for me to process because when you pour your heart and soul into something, you want it to work. But unfortunately, yeah. Sometimes it just doesn't.
Yeah, okay. So why in Switzerland? Because you're French, basically. Why didn't you choose French ATC?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, which goes back to what I was saying previously. Out of high school, I really wasn't a good student. In France, you have kind of two levels of, let's say, post A-level or high school studies, mm-hmm. which are either you go to the top of the best, they go to classe prépa, which is basically like a math and science boot camp for 2 years, and then you get crappy grades, and then you have a selection process at the end, and then you can have access to a French ATC school. You can have also access to a state-sponsored pilot training. So it's, of course, the best option in France is to get your entire pilot training paid for by the state, which is excellent. But you do have to have an academic level that I didn't have at that time and that I never had in my life. So it would have, of course, been a good option to go to France, but it wasn't going to work out for me.
Okay, yeah, that's why you didn't do any prep classes at the time.
No, it wasn't. It would just wasn't something that would have been a good fit for me, and so I went to just directly an engineering school, which was there was no like competition. It was if everybody passes, and that's it. Of course, not everybody passed, but it was. I mean, there was no competition, and that I'm not a very mm-hmm. competitive person, so it was much better for me.
Yeah, it was a kind of integrated prep classes.
Exactly, yeah.
So, honestly, we can hear a little bit of Swiss accent in your voice, but we can hear as well a little bit of American accents. Did you go to the USA?
Yeah. I'm surprised it still shows, but I've tried. So, yes, I've spent 4 years in the United States. I've tried removing the American accent because in this internationally speaking English, it's not the best accent I found for being understood throughout the world. But yeah, my father so works for Dassault Aviation on the Rafale as well, and now on the new fighter that they're preparing. And part of the Dassault group is also Dassault Falcon Jet, who make the beautiful at that time. It was the Falcon 50, the 900, and the 2000, which was brand new when we went there. And we got the possibility to go for initially, I think it was 3 years. You could go to Little Rock, which is in Arkansas, so the state just north to Louisiana. For those who don't know where it is, it's the city of Bill Clinton, if that helps, which probably doesn't. And that's they actually do the finishing on the Falcon aircraft. So the main structure, just to the point where the airplane can fly and have the instrumentation, this is done in near Bordeaux in France. And then the rest, the airplanes get shipped across the Atlantic to Little Rock, and then they get finished there. So that's why I spent there. It was planned for 3, and then I stayed 4 years, which was an awesome experience, very life-changing, I would say.
Yeah, sure. Can't imagine. So after having been fired from SkyGuide, what did you do at that time? Did you go back to the engineer position?
So after having been fired from SkyGuide after about 20 months, more or less, it was very traumatic experience for me. I must say it was a really low point in my life. I would even go go as far as saying. At this point, it was really one of those crossroads moments where you kind of have to look at your options. The job market for pilots at that time, it was 2013, was just plain awful, I think you can say. It had not recovered from 2008. There were some signs that it was improving in the United States, which of course is not so well correlated to Europe. So at this time, there was basically a choice to make. And I was already about 25 at that stage, and I'd already been, 5 years engineering study plus another almost 2 years of air traffic control training. So I'd been in studying for 7 years. So that's already five can be considered long, I think. And then seven was already a lot. And, my wife, she's like, okay, well, what do we do now? And then we kind of weighed the pros and cons. And I said, okay, I need to try to give it a shot at this becoming an airline pilot dream. So we said, okay, well, it's a bit different from when you're 25, from when you're 18, not crazy different, but still quite a lot. We decided that we were going to give it a shot, but that we wouldn't give it an unreasonable shot. By that, I mean that, sometimes you see on pilot forums, you see on the internet, people say, yeah, I want to become an airline pilot at any cost. Well, that was not my case. I said, okay, I'm not going to do this. If this means that my quality of life is awful, I'm not going to do it. If this means that I have to move to the other side of the world in a country where aviation norms are not what I would consider acceptable. It's very subjective analysis, but this was my analysis. I'm not going to, make my life miserable for this. Basically we said, okay, we want to stay in Europe. I wanted to go back to the US, but it's quite complicated for a European to get there. And then you have to, the whole pay your dues process, as they call it in the US, is a little bit different from what we have in Europe. So it's almost actually impossible as an airline pilot if you don't have the green card. And the green card, it takes a while to get it. And it's a lottery and everything. So yeah, basically to go to the US was something I would have wanted to do at that time. Then we said, okay, no, that's not going to work. So basically what we said is that I would go to a school that had partnerships with airlines. And I met this guy who was an airline pilot. I met him on the internet, and he was an airline pilot in Geneva for a low-cost airline based there. And we talked for a while, and I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. And we made the plan and say, okay, it was kind of all your eggs in one basket kind of arrangement. But I said, okay, we'll figure it out. And also, by the time all these plans came together and the mental process came to fruition, I had gotten a job as IT engineer. So this was kind of a step back for me. Of course, I'm not saying it's bad to be an IT engineer. That's not at all what I'm saying. But I was trying to get into aviation, and then I had to take a very big step back. And then I went through a few jobs like this, and I found one that was really good. So I had been able, almost accidentally, to be able to get an IT position that was livable, that I could see myself doing for 5 or 10 years if necessary. So I was in no rush. So it was okay. I will do the training. I will pay for it because Swiss salaries are very good, and we had the low cost of living. So I could pay for it all out of pocket up to the type rating. So the financial risk was almost non-existent. And then we did it like this, and we said, okay, well, if, for example, so the bar that we set was Ryanair. So it's entirely acceptable airline. It gives their chances to a lot of people. But we said, okay, I don't want to go to Ryanair. So any employment deal which would be worse than Ryanair, then I'll just say no. And maybe it will cost me my dream. And we decided that that would be acceptable.
Yeah, but you took your shot.
Yeah, we both came to agreement with my wife. So, okay, we'll give it a try with limited risk, because the training that I did was kind of like part-time. This was modular training. So it was really ideal because I was working in this quite a great IT company, and they gave me 90% part-time. I asked for it, and part-time is something that's very common in Switzerland. So that was really an excellent deal. And I had all the flexibility because they were really just so, so, so kind with me, and say, okay, tomorrow morning I go flying. They say, okay, And then maybe I'd go to the office. Oh, the weather wasn't good enough, so I didn't go fly. But okay. So I had this arrangement where I could work and fly at the same time. It was a bit challenging, but it was much, much, much easier than just quitting my job, having a one-year gap in my resume, and then having to find potentially another IT job after that. So it was really, really an excellent situation in this regard.
Yeah, perhaps your IT job was kind of a goldmine for you, being able perhaps to do some work from home. Perhaps it was a step back initially, but I think it was as well a good point for you.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Huh? In the beginning, it really, you know, I had air traffic control training didn't work out, and it's really a big disappointment to go back. But you're entirely right. Initially, it didn't feel like a very big step forward, but in hindsight, and then even as time went on, it was a very big step forward for me, because I had been able to, first, just being able to bounce back was already a big step forward. It's not pleasant initially, but then when you bounce back, you see that you're able to make it work, and then things start moving forward again, and then more positivity. And then during that time, you know, I lost some time, but it wasn't lost, because then everything started opening back up again. Airlines started hiring again. The airline I was shooting for was hiring more and more. So in the end, it was very much a step forward, even though it didn't feel like it in the beginning.
Yeah, sure. And where did you do your flying training?
So I did it in Aerospace. So it's quite a small school when you compare it to, for example, NAL3 or Oxford Aviation Academy, things like this. But it has a partnership with a few airlines, including mainly the only one I was interested in was the airline in Geneva, the low cost in Geneva. And so it was really great. It's a small school, not like a pilot factory at all. So it was a very good compromise. And it was only a 10-minute drive from my job. So this was really ideal.
Yeah, great. So how long did it take for you?
So the first part, as most everyone knows, to the airline pilot training is the ATPL theory. You can discuss this in length, but it's to do it full time, I think it's hard because it's difficult, there's a lot of material to learn, but to do it on the side of a job is also fairly challenging. The main reason to that is that what happens is that, so you will go to a normal everyday work, and then you come back home, and then you have 10 minutes free time, and then you start working on a few questions. And then you go to bed, and then you're waiting on something, you have 15 minutes, and bam, 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 you do some more ATPL questions. So it's really, you get no downtime, and then it's just questions, and then it's, of course, you have to be very consistent, because if you do it 1 week on, 1 week off, then you start forgetting, and then you don't build up this routine. So you have to really have this routine of basically having no free time and spending it all on the ATPL series. So this took me 14 months. Of course, air traffic control training really helped in these circumstances, because a lot of topics I'd heard before, also just being an aviation enthusiast taught me a few things. So this is how it turned out. So the initial 14 months, so this brings us to June 2014. And then the practical part, of course, is pretty quick compared to the ATPL theory done in this way. I started in June, and by November I had an IFR single engine, and then I had the multi-engine by January 2015, and then the MCC right then, and then February 2016 I had my CPL. So I had the whole let's say newbie package, CPL, instrument rating, multi, by a little under a year after starting the training and doing it part-time. So that was a nice pace with the also my job had picked up, because it was a startup. So you have these startups that grow slower, and you have the startups that grow faster. And I was very lucky in a way to be in a startup that was growing very, very, very fast. So of course, this comes with a number of very interesting challenges, and I had to manage the two. And it was really a great time. I when I look back onto this time, I thought it was really great.
Yeah, sure. Your flying school was not linked at all to the company that you had on your radar at that time?
Yes, actually it was. Basically, it's always complicated because the airlines, they don't want to really have a formal deal sometimes. But the advantage of that school, so Switzerland is a small country. Of course, there are not 100 schools that do professional pilot training. And so this, you can split Switzerland into two or three parts, depending how you see it, but mainly three parts, the French-speaking, the German-speaking, and Italian-speaking. And this is basically the only school in the French-speaking part, and that airline being based in Geneva was one of the only airlines based airlines, as in like Airbus and regular line flying type airline, was the only one based in Geneva. So they have a partnership. So it's not like a straight shot, but basically the hiring criteria for that airline is either you have 500 hours of A320 time, which of course I had absolutely none coming out of pilot training, like most every newbie pilot, or if you come from a list of approved school, and that school was on that list.
Okay. Good, great. Before talking about the assessments, did you ever consider flying for the military?
That's an excellent question. Yeah, I mean, my father worked on military airplanes, so that was always a consideration. But actually, no, not really. But it's kind of, now today, I kind of wonder why I made, was it really a choice or not? In a way, it was. But I never applied, basically. I think the military would not have been a very good fit for me in terms of culture and everything. So I don't think I had much of a chance. But since I didn't apply, I have in reality no idea. So it was never something that really interested me to take the step and go for it. So no.
Yeah, I think you're right, because you need to have a lot of motivation just to join the military, and it's very specific and it doesn't fit to everybody. So.
That's what on the internet there were people talking about this, and they were saying, because I mean the job of flying a Rafale, I mean that's incredible, you can't argue against that really, but I saw a lot of people who were saying if you join the Air Force, you're not first a pilot and then military personnel, you're first military personnel then a pilot, and I realized that this would not be a good fit for me.
Coming back to the assessments, the company you had on your radar at that time is very specific for the assessments. So how did you prepare yourself?
Well, the first thing that happens, like every newbie pilot, you exit pilot training. So you're really very goal focused. It's this step, then next step, then next step. Then once you have everything, then it all stops. So first of all, you discover what it's like to have free time again. It's very bizarre, but enjoyable feeling. And then you really feel completely lost. I think this is a very normal feeling. And as I said, I didn't want to do this at any price. And this airline that I had on my radar was something I really wanted to do. And it was really my primary focus. So we had said with my wife, okay, I will wait for this airline before applying to any others. Of course, how long this would have stuck, I don't know. And so once I had done the pilot training, the school, they said, okay, we had a meeting with my airline, and they said that there would be another 10 months before they have any assessments. I was like, okay, then now you're really facing the wall and you say, I said I'd do it. Okay, I do it. I will wait. Well, as often, timing is everything. And but I mean, they had met with the head of training of the airline. And he had said, okay, 10 months. I was like, okay. And then they call me back 2 weeks later and say, Antoine, the application window has opened. Apply right now. I was like, what? You said another 10 months. I was like, oh, okay, I don't ask questions. I just applied. So I was really waiting for the long haul. And by just pure luck at this stage, it worked out and they opened the window, and then the assessment starts. And then this is, I think, a very unpleasant phase for just about everybody, unless you have already a job. But yeah, so they open the assessment. I apply. Okay. I get, they have this online thing. So you have many things to prepare yourself on the internet. It's very well known what back in the days you had like a flash games. It's a bit similar, but not as fun, because you're really betting your career on your performance at these flash games.
I think it's a missile flash game.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I do remember this one. This was the fun one. So I was a big gamer before in my teen days. So yeah, there's like a tunnel, and then you have to avoid some obstacles. So this was the fun part. This I enjoy. You had one that was a mental calculation. This I enjoy a lot. So this was fun. And you had one. So these were okay, I found. And you had one where it was basically an English reading exercise. So, I mean, I have no problem reading normally, and no problem with English. But it was just very difficult. And I did just so poorly on that one. Most everybody will say that they did poorly on it as well. But I'm pretty sure I did very poorly on that one. So once it's done, normally you get an email, and I didn't get that email. So my friends got an email saying that they passed. There is a minimum bar, which is apparently quite low. So you get an email if you pass. And then I don't know if you get an email if you fail, but I got no email. So it was just like 3 days, and I was like, oh man, you know, you really feel like crap, basically. And I was like, oh, what's happening? I just failed. I lost and everything. I'm like, okay. And then a friend said, but did you click log out? I was like, well, yeah, okay. Well, let me see again. And then I went back to the system, and then I didn't click on the right button, and then I clicked it and I got the email. So I spent 3 days worrying for nothing. And then a number of people were at my flight school. They got invites. And they got invites for a date 3 weeks later. So initially they tell me, oh, I received a message. Oh, look, I got an invite for this and this date. I was like, ooh, okay, maybe I get an invite. Then 1 day passes, then 2 days pass, then three, then four, then seven. And I was like, oh, no, I didn't get called. And I kind of, at this time, I was really, really feeling like crap. And then I told my wife, okay, I'm tired of this. We haven't had a holiday in a year and a half. So we take some holidays. We go fly a Cessna White 82 in the US. And I'm tired of this. Just take 3 days of paid leave, 3 weeks of paid leave, and we go on holiday. I'm tired of this. But I'll put it just right after the selection process, just in case a miracle happens. And just as we did that, in fact, I received, so was it four, well, I think it was 5 days before the date, I got an email. Oh, Antoine, you're invited. I was like, so, which was 2 weeks after all my friends. So I was very... Yeah, I was very surprised. I was like, okay, now I got to prepare. But 5 days is a very short time. And in the way they did the assessment in Switzerland is that you would have all the like the group exercise, the individual interview. And then at the end of that day, they say pass, no pass. And then you would go to the sim straight away.
Yeah.
So this would be, so it was first of all, a very long day. And also it was all in one. So you couldn't say, okay, I'll prepare the group exercise and everything in one phase, and then I'll prepare the sim another phase. No, you had to prepare it all at once. So it was, it was interesting. Through my air traffic control training and selection process, and also my IT work, I had the chance to have some proficiency in interviewing. I had done quite a few interviews because, of course, every time you get a new job, you get new interviews. And it's I also hired a number of people in a growing startup and everything. So all the group exercise part, I was fairly clear on what they expected. And the individual interview, I was not too much worried about it. It was mainly the sim, and of course the sim you have to go prepare on the airplane. I did the MCC on 737, so it was A320. So I just went to the sim center and I say, okay, just let's go and train. And it was very good, and I recommend everyone doing it. I've seen and heard people that say, oh no, I don't need to prepare the sim. And yes, you need to prepare the sim. And most people that I've heard said that, actually all in my experience, didn't pass the sim, unsurprisingly, I would say.
And then you joined the company, you had your training. Your job, your current job, is a low-cost airline pilot. That's different than a legacy airline pilot. In what areas is it different for you?
Yeah, for me, it's a little bit difficult to compare because I've only had this one job as an airline pilot, but I have a number of friends who went on to Air France, which is almost all people that have left my current airline have gone to a major legacy airline, which is Air France. I would say a lot of things. Oftentimes, what you hear is that people will kind of put all low cost airlines in the same box, and I think that's a very incorrect way of seeing it. You have it's the same for major legacy airlines as well. You have some differences, and in matter of low cost airlines, you have very big differences. I don't want to get too political here, but for me, it was always important to have an airline that recognized pilot unions and that considered that it was important to have a discussion with the pilots as to the working conditions and everything. So this was a very important point. And not all low-cost airlines are similar in this regard. So I think this is also very important to the job that we have day to day. And I'm lucky to have an airline that does work in this matter. It's not perfect, of course, but it's very good in this regard. So this was an important point in terms of the low-cost, different low-cost airlines. One main point, and this is a huge positive for me, is that I'm home every night. I live 15 minutes away from the airport by car, but the parking is 15 minutes away from the queue room. So basically, I leave home 35 minutes before I check in. So this is very nice. And I'm home every night. And of course, if you want to see the world and do all the nice night stops and everything, it's not an ideal job. But if you're a little bit older with a child and everything, then this is really a huge, huge bonus. It's very predictable. And yeah, so this is a very nice part of working for low-cost airline. One of the downsides, maybe if you call it that, is that it's a single-type airline, like a big number of low-cost airlines. So it's the A3, well, it's 19, 20, and 21, but it's not a huge diversity. So that's a little bit of a downside. Given the fact that I'm home every night, for me, at the current time, I would say it's quite worth it.
Yeah, everything is a matter of compromise as well. And if you're a family guy, that's good to be home every day. So every night, it's the same for me and my company. So I'm pretty sure of the answer, but I think you don't have a kind of stable roster. It's kind of a random roster for you.
Yeah, so, well, as with all these rostering topics, it varies. Like most low-cost airlines in Europe, they're multinationals, multi-AOC. So if you're depending on where you're based, the arrangements are going to be very, very different. So actually, you're right. We have what you could call a random roster. But thanks to the contract, it is made in a way that it is not so random, in fact. It's, well, disregarding the COVID days, the current days before, it was it's actually quite predictable because they're not allowed to do a certain thing. They can't schedule you for more than 5 days, for example. They can't give you less than 2 days off, and that they can only do once a month. And we have a number of arrangements that are really, really very good, where we can have days off in advance that are no approval required and things like this. So if you kind of play the game and do a little bit of strategical days off, you can get it pretty predictable. Also, I have the advantage of about a year and a half after I joined the company, I became TKI, so theoretical knowledge instructor. So this also gives me some predictability because the training days are predictable. So that's one of the big advantages. Pre-COVID, I had almost every weekend off. So that was also great. So it's random, yes, but I would say it's more an advantage because you can kind of mold it because we have the contract that allows for that.
Yeah. You told me that sometimes you have one day off and then you go back to work.
No, actually, that's one of the nice things we don't have is we never have single days off. So it's always two, and that can only be once a month.
Yeah, because according to my experience on how you fly, and not how you fly, but how you manage the turnaround and all that stuff. It's very quick. It's very fast. It happens very fast. So you have kind of 30 minutes of turnaround, then you do something like four sectors a day, don't you?
Yeah, it depends. So yeah, it's true that one of the big things for the low-cost models was these short turnarounds. So on the A320, we do 35 minutes is the standard turnaround. Anything below that is sometimes planned, but it just doesn't work. It's almost impossible with full airplanes, which we almost always had and quite frequently still had this summer. So yeah, for me, 35 minutes, it's great. I would say that's more an advantage than a disadvantage. Of course, the perception of this is very different, whether it's the flight crew, the cabin crew, or the ground crew. For the ground crew, these 35 minutes is very, very tight. They're really under a lot of pressure to make it work, and it's very difficult for them. For the cabin crew, it's the same. That's 186 or even more with the 321 passengers, and that's very tight for them. They have a lot of work, and they have to do a lot of things in a very short amount of time, which is these 35 minutes. For the flight crew, I would say it's just right. 35 minutes, that's I'm not going to say it too loudly, but that's, you know, I have 10 minutes that I can spend sending a few text messages back home and doing a little bit of something else during the turnaround. So as a flight crew, these 35 minutes, I'm very happy with that, I must say. Now, you're right. Also, we do these 4-sector days, which, of course, nobody likes too much. But yeah, that's part of the job. When there are four short sectors, it's quite okay. I don't mind it too much. Then when you start having these 12, well, maybe not 12, but 11 hours duty days with 4 sectors, then yeah, the first one, it's okay. The second one, it's a bit more tiring. And the third one, it starts to be difficult. But then we still have a lot of 2-sector days. In the summer, a little bit less. But in the winter, depending how you arrange your schedule, you have a lot of these 2-sector days. We do a little bit longer flights also during the winter mainly. So that's it's kind of a nice break too. It's really cooling down in the winter, not just in terms of temperature, but also the work rhythm.
Yeah, man, 35 minutes of turnaround is very, it's pretty low and very fast compared to the 1 hour and 10 minutes we have for us in legacy aircraft, you know, a legacy company flying the A330. So coming back to my point, so your 4 sectors, I think it's very tiring. And if they don't do any kind of, let's say, intelligent roster, it can be an issue for you in a fatigue-wise point of view.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think fatigue is an issue for almost all pilots in a way or another. You know, even if you do just 1 sector, but you're flying the entire night, then you arrive in the morning and you're just out. But yeah, you're right. Fatigue is an issue. Currently, not so much, of course. But when we have these summers and you know, summer 2019, summer 2018, and all these were really crazy summers in Europe. Really, the level of traffic was just completely crazy, and it was just growing and growing and growing. And I'm not Eurocontrol, so I don't have very precise data on it, but from a pilot perspective, which is of course very limited, it really felt like we were kind of reaching the limits of the system, because you had all the time crazy slots, and then if there's a weather, then it was even crazier slots, and then the flights get canceled, and then you miss the curfew because there's a curfew in Geneva, then you end up in Lyon, and then you home at 5 a.m. and you can't do the next day. And it was just such chaos. It was a little bit improved in 2019. But the fatigue is a big issue. You have to manage it. And but the important part here is that I would say, at least it is my experience, that having a pilot union that is doing its job and an airline which is respectful of that, as is my case, and I feel fortunate that it is, but it shouldn't be. It should be like this everywhere. You know, if we call in fatigue, we say, okay, yeah, I'm sorry, I'm just too tired, then all they say is okay, and there's no further consequences, which unfortunately I've heard is not the case everywhere.
Yeah, so what's your schedule right now? I'm sure it's pretty low, but did you have a kind of, because I've read that your company, your global company in Europe was kind of doing well.
Yeah, as you will expect, it's survival mode for everybody. But of course, there's going to be a very big difference. And I think this will continue, I hope, for not too long for everybody. But unfortunately, I think it will still be at least 2 years, something like this. Is that since we're just a medium haul airlines, just flying the 320, and the European Union has done, I would consider, quite a few good things. They're trying to harmonize the restrictions. They're trying to put things in place so that people can go on holiday, so that the travel and tourism industry is not just dying, which it is in most places currently. So that's a big positive. The airline also has responded in quite a good way to all of this, I would say. And one of the most important points for me directly is that, so I am considered a Swiss employee, and the Swiss government has really put in place some excellent measures to try to just steady the situation, make sure people don't get fired. It will probably happen at one time or another. I'm not having too many illusions in this regard, but a lot of good things have put in place in Europe to make sure that not everybody gets fired, basically. So that's a good point. Also, what is a very big plus for me is that compared to some other neighboring countries, this is of course very subjective, but Switzerland has been, as is often the case, has had a very measured approach to this entire situation, and it really shows. Huh? You really see people are still willing to travel. Switzerland is a country that has a very large percentage of its population that comes from somewhere else. So a lot of people, almost everybody that I know, in fact, in Switzerland has some family in Portugal, in Spain, in France, in Germany, in Italy. So people want to travel, they want to see their families, which is entirely normal. So people are willing to travel and want to travel thanks to this whole situation as a whole. So in July, I think I had almost a full roster, because we get our normal rosters and then just some days are called technical unemployment. And I think I had 3 days technical unemployment in July and just two in August. I consider myself very, very lucky compared to what I've heard elsewhere.
Oh yeah, definitely. You can here in Hong Kong, it's the government shut down all the borders. So that means that if you're not Hong Kong resident, you can't proceed to the country. A very big company here that is employing myself had like something like 800 passengers, 900 passengers per day. Wow. And it's something like 1% of the passengers they've done last year. So that's not very good news. And I think that, the things are average in Europe, because I went back to France a few months ago now. The flights, so not the international flights, so the Hong Kong to Zurich was not full. Of course, it was like something like a quarter to a third passengers inside the aircraft. But the flights from Zurich to Paris was full. The flight from Paris to Marseille was full as well. And because I'm traveling with staff travel, I missed the plane from Paris to Marseille. And I just had to take the next flight. So yeah, for me, it's the traffic compared to Hong Kong. The traffic in Europe is way more dense, and that's good news, I think.
Yeah. It's very interesting that you're saying this regarding France. It is exactly my experience that, of course, what is happening is that it is a good and a bad sign. You have a lot of no-shows, so people which will have bought a ticket but don't come. So on maybe 186, you will have 20, 30 people that have bought the ticket that don't come. In the short term, of course, it's good for the airline because it's just basically free money. But in the long term, it's maybe not so great. But we'll have to wait and see. Yeah, I mean, flights that are 80, 90% full, I've definitely seen that more than I've seen flights that were 20 to 30% empty. But as we saw, initially, the Spanish flights were quite full because a lot of people want to go to Spain. This is a big market for us, Spain and Italy during the summer. But then it started, I think, mid-July when there was Barcelona and Catalonia, which was starting to not shut down, but, you know, be in the news and everything. And the load factors were really way, way down. And then there was the quarantine that was imposed from Switzerland, from people coming back from Spain to Switzerland. So that was one problem. But we're lucky in this regard because Geneva is basically just close to France. So a lot of French people will fly from Geneva. And of course, if you go from Spain to France, there's no mandatory quarantine to my knowledge. So we kind of have this redundancy in terms of our clientele. But yeah, it's still a very flexible situation. But it is quite good. And At least it was quite good this summer, I must say, because for this end of summer, September is still the summer, I guess, in a way. But even for fall and for the ski season, then I think the expectation is it will go down very low.
I'm not sure that it will go down very low, but yeah, low to medium low, I think. But yeah, lucky for you, you'll have some time just to record your podcast. Can you tell us a bit about Parlons Aviation podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was working as an IT engineer, I had about an hour drive to go to work, which is a little bit long, but not crazy long. And of course, when you're in the car and you're doing nothing, then that's more or less time lost. So I was listening to a lot of podcasts, English language podcasts, the very well-known ones such as Airplane Geeks, Airline Pilot Podcast. I had, Airline Pilot Guy. I had enough time to listen to all of it at one point. Not anymore, but unfortunately. So I was listening to a lot of podcasts and I enjoyed it a lot. I like the format. I like the information that people are giving out. It's, it's very, I just think it's just great format in the end. And so once I was hired by the airline, and then you have an airline schedule, which is of course very different from a 9-to-5 normal schedule. And I didn't have kids at that time also, which makes a big difference. So I had a lot of free time, and I was like, okay, what can I do with my free time? And I said, yeah, I'll make a podcast. This kind of like a bar countertop idea, but it was not on a bar countertop, but still. And I said, okay, yeah, I'll give it a try. We'll see. Maybe it just doesn't work, and then I will have had fun with it, and then we'll see. At that time, it was more or less the only French language aviation podcast. Now there have been a few others, and there's also one that is just like a radio show that gets put out as a podcast. But at that time, it was the only one. So I said, okay, I'll give it a try. And initially, I was kind of searching for the format. I enjoy a lot of Airplane Geeks, and I like the technical aspects of things. I do a lot of, well, I used to at least. Pre-COVID, do a lot of instructions. I do instruction via my airline for the 320 type ratings and all the recurrent events. And I also do ATPL theory training at my previous flight school. And I said, okay, well, I like technical stuff. Maybe somebody likes it as well. And I got started through this and I did it. And then one thing led to another. It improved. Now, when I look back at the first episodes, they weren't very good, but that's fine. And then it was very surprising how many people are interested into topics and discussions about aviation, and I get a lot of people that seem to be interested, so it's very nice. I'm very happy with it.
You've been listening to the Nanjis Podcast, an aviation podcast. If you like this show, subscribe and share on Apple Podcast, Spotify, and all the podcast platforms. You can as well follow us on Instagram on the Nanjis Podcast account. Thanks again for listening.